So welcome to A Correction Podcast. I'm your host, Lev Moskow, and today we have a very special show. It is a post-election show. Today is November the 10th. It's the evening here in New York, and we still don't for sure know that Joe Biden will be our next president, but we think so. And I'm here, I'm joined by Ernest Boyd and Fiore Berhani, and maybe Ernest and Fiore, you could just reintroduce yourselves to the audience. You've both been on the show before, but just a reintroduction would be fantastic.
Yeah. My name is Ernest Boyd. I'm a film editor. I was on the show. I was a host about New York City and the transition from the 70s to the 80s, the political economy of that time. And yeah, it's nice to be back.
I'm Fiore Berhane. I spoke in June about COVID-19 and detention in the Mediterranean. I'm a PhD candidate and social anthropologist, political anthropologist. So I think that gives me a little bit of credibility to talk about politics in the U.S. And I'm American, so.
I think you both have lots of credibility. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to you today. Let's just start with the big question. You know, how are you feeling? So first, I should say that on Saturday afternoon, when the news broke that Biden was probably going to be our next president because he had won the Electoral College, more specifically, he had just won Pennsylvania. I was at a farmer's market in Brooklyn. Jubilation erupted and champagne bottles. I don't know if these people were just carrying them around just in case, but champagne bottles were opened, corks popped. And I then spent the next couple hours in Prospect Park with very, very happy people. I was, of course, not disappointed that Trump lost, but I felt a bit alienated. I'm wondering how the two of you are feeling about the news and how you felt on Saturday. So maybe we start with you, Berhane, and then Ernest.
You know, on Saturday, I was happy. I was just like, oh, relief, in kind of very selfish ways, because I really need to travel to do my own research. I think my feelings quickly kind of dissipated as I started seeing these public statements around, you know, the resounding idea that it was socialism that cost the election in Florida, and this repudiation of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which was very, very swift in its arrival. And so I genuinely kind of felt I felt sad, and I still continue to do so. I think we're in a kind of interregnum, in this kind of strange moment. And then also I felt that sense of alienation that you point to, Lev, because everyone was so happy, but I thought, well, there are so many structural issues at play, so many legal issues. There are arcane laws that govern transitions between presidents that people haven't thought about. And so I feel, in a strange sense, I thought that I would feel more certainty, but that sense of uncertainty and feeling unmoored actually followed from those feelings of kind of relief, initial feelings of relief.
Yeah, I don't think it's crazy to say that we're all happy that Trump is out of here. I think it's also safe to say that many of us are not excited that it's Biden who's the president. So I think two things can be true at the same time. And I definitely didn't feel a sense of jubilation just because of what Fiore is saying, of what others are saying. There are structural issues that go well beyond who we vote in for president. I think that there are issues down the road. This is, in some sense, to me, kicking the can down the road, because those greater problems are going to rear their head one of these days. So I feel like Fiore again, where this is an interregnum and it's going to take a little time to tell where we're headed. Maybe at best, it gives the left a little time to really get its shit together. But outside of that, there's really not a lot to be too happy for. Now, there are dangers as well, which we can go into. The dangers of a Democratic presidency being hawkish and can actually improve the material interests of those who are here. But what does it do to the material interests of those overseas, say in Venezuela, say in China, so on and so forth? So those are things I also think about.
I want to come back to this point of kicking the can down the road. What do you mean by that? What are some of the issues that we are not facing today?
Well, to be very specific about it, there are reasons why Trump came into office. And it'd be interesting to hear Fiore speak about this. He's a white supremacist. He's a racist. He's a misogynist. He's got authoritarian tendencies. He's also anti-systemic. One might say populist. I don't really like that term. But he is not so different from many other leaders across the globe, especially in the Western industrialized countries, Italy, Hungary, so on and so forth. And he's not so different from those who are making inroads in countries like France and Germany. So I think we have to deal with the underlying issues, such as what's happened to working classes and middle classes in the advanced industrialized countries over the past 40, 50 years to actually make many of them excited about voting in this anti-systemic, almost proto-fascist type of leader.
One really important facet is this kind of immense deregulation of the financial industries. And people like Trump and those with whom he allies are part of a kind of a transnational mafia capitalism in which, you know, you move money around in these illicit manner. And, you know, Trump himself is ideologically empty in most ways. And I think even some of his supporters don't read him as racist, right? I think many political opportunists have latched on to him. You know, Stephen Miller is an obvious racist. He has a plan, which is to dramatically curtail all kinds of immigration from the global south, which has actually caused quite a few problems for the US. We don't have enough skilled workers in tech and medicine, education, in fact, severely curtailed H-1B visas. And the media kept focusing on the 500 children who were not reunited from their parents. These are just escalation of policies, the immigration policies that have actually been quite longstanding, that have been punitive in their nature, that have been based on the idea of increasing the risks of unauthorized migration, of making it deadly. It started with Bill Clinton and prevention and deterrence. So even Republican, if we were to listen to Republican debates in the 1980s around immigration, even Republicans were advocating for periodic immigration amnesties to legalize people's status. If you look at the common sense around migration policies globally, Trump is not an aberration. He's not an exception. He's just an acceleration of existing norms. So I've often thought it was really interesting that a lot of attention has been fixed on the persona of Trump, who's kind of illiberal, uncouth, vulgar, comedic, in fact, a bit carnivalesque. And I think that it's really fascinating that people are paying so much more attention to the performance rather than the fact that, you know, substantively what Trump did was to, you know, just the regular Republican line of radically redistributing state resources to the top, gutting environmental protections, gutting the kind of administrative state, and just this simple kind of like neoliberal playbook, which is no different from his predecessors in many ways. But I think the person of Trump allowed, and how horrendous he was, may have opened people's eyes to some of the structural issues that we face regarding environmental protection, the degradation of the administrative state, the gutting of regulations, our punitive and racist immigration policies that maybe people didn't pay attention to before. My fear is that they're just going to think, okay, that's just Trump. Trump is gone. These problems are finished.
Both Obama's immigration policy and Trump's immigration policy sort of reminds me of the conversation we had about EU immigration policy. You know, Trump, I remember saying something like, look, we're just doing what the Europeans have done for a long time. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I mean, yes, but they also inform one another, and they, you know, migration policies are normalized across supranational entities. So, I mean, I write about border externalization deals. Well, you know, the first country to kind of externalize its borders to create these island detention centers to keep asylum seekers as far away as possible was Australia. And this policy started in the early 2000s. countries, the US, Canada, et cetera, decried this policy as extra legal detention, as a contravention of human rights, as an abrogation of asylum itself and the 1951 conventions on the rights of refugees. But the second country to do that then was Italy. And then after that, it became an EU policy to do these border externalization deals with Turkey to keep Syrians out and Libya to keep Africans out and Ukraine and the entire kind of neighborhood of European countries. And then finally, the last person to do this was actually Trump. Yeah, the last figure to actually outsource asylum. And this is actually quite recent, relatively, was actually the Trump administration, which is now asking Mexico to hold asylees. Because normally the law has always stipulated that it doesn't matter how you enter, if you have a credible asylum claim, if you're credibly a political refugee, that's enshrined in the conventions of the rights of refugees. In some ways, I think the problem of Trump is that he calls out the hypocrisy of liberal regimes. He's an unrepentant liar, but he's strangely honest too. So he does tell unpalatable truths while he tells at the same time bogus lies.
Ernest, both you and Fiore mentioned that perhaps what's going on globally is that there's been Fiore, you talked about the financialization of our economy and quote unquote advanced economies. I mean, in general, and Ernest, you talked about the hollowing out of the working class, the middle class. And I'd like to talk more about that. But when you read liberal economists like Paul Krugman, you know, they say again and again, what we're seeing with Trump and the rise of populism is not about economic anxiety. But that seems like that's what you're pointing to. So how do we explain that?
Yeah, I'd have to think through this. I think when I actually stopped reading Krugman a long time ago. But when they say it has nothing to do with economic anxiety, then how do we explain Europe? How do we explain, say, Brazil? And I think that we have to think of these things as in ways that are not reductionist and that they're, in a sense, overdetermined, meaning that they don't have we can't just think of these things in one way. So that doesn't quite answer the question, but I do think it's important to realize that about 50 years ago, once capital went global, once all those barriers to trade came down, it was only a matter of time in the advanced West or the advanced industrialized West that those factories, those jobs that provided of what they call a Fordist wage were just sent overseas and gone. And what that did to subjectivity, what that did objectively, I think those chickens are coming home to roost right now. So yes, mix that with the toxic stew of racism in this country and the history of racism, and you get a backlash against these elites. And I think to Fiore's point, someone like Trump came into power. Remember, like Obama ran against the Iraq war. Trump actually, in some sense, ran as like an isolationist. And so I think that this country still has those strands of isolationism. It's only World War II that really made this country somewhat internationalist. And I don't mean that in a good way, but this country has always had a deep isolationist strain. And I think Trump tapped into that. So I think that when Krugman says it's not just economic, of course not. It's never just that. I think what he's doing is he's attacking anyone on the left who even brings economics into the argument.
Which is strange for an economist to do that. But it's interesting. I mean, his argument is, and I'm curious to hear what both of you think about it. And his argument is, and I think lots of liberals, their argument is, look, this is about racial resentment. And, you know, I had a friend this weekend say, bottom line, fuck white men. And
I think,
I wonder what you think of
that.
I
mean, that's kind of an absurd statement. If we think about racial resentments as long sedimented as, you know, always there and ready to be activated at any point, why are they erupting across the world at the same time, and not only in the advanced industrial economies of the West, but also in places like India under Modi. India, which is a kind of non-biopolitical state. India that's a liberal democracy, one of the largest democracies in the world, where you have majoritarian populism and immense inequalities. and anti-Muslim sentiment and casteism. So I think that that is a kind of absurd statement to make. Culture is never divorced from the material circumstances that people find themselves in, ever, as a cultural anthropologist. And how people understand morality, ethics, environment is also deeply ideologically attuned. And I think that we're in a moment in which, I like this quote, my favorite, neoliberalism has been continually intellectually undermined and rejected, yet its political salience and its political embeddedness continues to grow. But I think we're at a point in which we're living through kind of a rentierism and an extractivism that, and what I mean by rentierism is that when you park wealth and you hide it in these kinds of islands in which there's no regulation, there's no tax regime that can tax this money. That's what we learned from the publication of the Panama Papers. You kind of create this situation in which you have no productive energies in society. So all you do to make more profit is that you take as much as you get in these non-productive ways from the remaining working people, from the state, from state agencies. And in my own work, I see the most radical and cruel versions of this rentierism at work in how refugees are exploited at every turn by both institutional humanitarianism and by the extra legal dimensions through which governments around the world are trying to keep these people out. And the lines between the illicit and licit economies are pretty blurred. There is just rife criminality around the world, financial criminality. So it's not just neoliberalism. I think we're at a transition point is what we're seeing. And that Trump heralds, someone like Trump heralds that transition. He's its embodiment. You know, he is someone who has used laws to avoid paying taxes, whose financial empire is based on criminality, chicanery, lying, cheating, mafia style tactics.
Fiore, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, as you are an expert on Italian politics, but I'm wondering whether or not you see Berlusconi as an analog.
Yeah, I mean, he stayed in power for a very long time. And finally, his heir apparent, Matteo Salvini, came and went. Yes, I do. In many ways, I think, I mean, Berlusconi had a media empire, whereas, I mean, Trump doesn't have a media empire. But, you know, there were always questions as to where did this money come? The Italian journalists and commentators, where did Berlusconi's money come from? How did this man go from someone who literally sang show tunes on cruises to owning a huge share of Italian media? I don't know, close to 90% at some point, but I don't know if those figures are entirely accurate. Yeah, yes, I mean, he took on this kind of blustering populist affect, this I'm an everyman, I am Italian, like I represent un arcitaliano. And so it became a politics of spectacle and performance in many of the ways that Trump is embodies. But there were so many investigations against him and his entire empire for those same reasons that Trump is being investigated. Except I think Berlusconi was probably smarter than Trump as a person.
I mean, I think there's one positive there, which is that, you know, Berlusconi eventually exited the stage. Of course,
20 years.
Right, after 20 years. And then, eventually you get, you know, Salvini, who's arguably worse. But at least there's an end to the nightmare, except that, you know, because there's all these similarities, actually, with many leaders around the world, that these structures, the structures of finance are the same and they're global. Those don't change. And so what it makes me, and frankly, those structures were shepherded in by also the Democratic Party or
everywhere.
Democratic Party everywhere, right? Like the Democratic Party in Italy, too, is pretty similar to what we got
Labor
here.
In the UK.
Right. And so we're living in some ways with the framework that those so-called center-left parties built. And Trump won't last forever, but Berlusconiism will, or I fear. We all seem to be really struggling with understanding why Trump got such a big percentage of the Latino vote, did pretty well with Black men, doubled the vote with Black women, did really well with Jewish people, with Muslim people, with white women. How do you understand those results?
Well, first of all, are they just exit polls or do we know them for sure?
Right. So these are exit polls. And so what makes it really tough is we don't know because there was so much early voting going on and voting by mail. We don't know if those numbers are real.
I'd like to see the final statistics, number one. Like, second of all, let's all remember that George Bush Jr. got 40 to 44% of the Latino vote in 2004. Latinos voting for Republicans is not something new, number one. Number two, I'd just like to go back to the fact that it's something between 6 and 9 million voters who went for Obama. They also went for Trump in 2016, those who went for Obama in 2012. So we probably have to try to wrap our minds around that as well. I'm not so sure I want to talk about the Black and Latin vote for Trump at this moment, just because I don't know all the numbers yet. And I'd have to wrap my mind around that for a little while. But some of it might have to do, I was talking to our homegirl, Stacy, who's of course from the Bronx, and she said that she knew, and this is kind of all anecdotal, of course, that she knew some Black and Latino folks voting for Trump because the Democratic Party has always been a racist party. So I found that very interesting, but somehow they didn't see the GOP as racist. Anyway, so I really don't have an answer for that. Fury might. I have yet to wrap my mind around it, though, until I really see some firm numbers.
I've been thinking about it a lot because I think the reason why commentators have latched onto this is because of not because they want to impugn these communities, but there's a kind of sense that this is totally counterintuitive when we look at Trump's statements and his policies that have targeted these communities and this whole summer of protests over the extrajudicial police killings of Black men and women and the total miscarriages of law and the kind of systemic injustice that we confront. You would think, okay, that would just seal the deal against Trump. A border wall, locking up kids. And so I think, first of all, I think there's kind of an incredulity to these numbers, these increases. But, the campaign actually targeted Black and Latino voters in particular. Like, that was one of their strategies, was to peel away voters from the Democratic Party. The other thing is, I do believe that it depends. I mean, when we think about Latinos, we have to disaggregate by class, by the circumstances of migration patterns. A lot of people kept saying, well, it's white Cubans and Venezuelans who were horrified by the specter of socialism as embodied by Bernie Sanders. I would have to disagree because we see also data showing that some of the poorest Latinos in border towns in Texas came out for Trump as well. But I think this is a big part of it has to do with targeted campaigns of disinformation and the rise of these kinds of conspiracy theories that have tried to delegitimize Black Lives Matter. I've seen this on the ground, QAnon and Child Lives Matter, that people I started seeing who had normally and nominally been liberal or who had who themselves had experienced racialized violence, all of a sudden going on about why does no one care about the lives of children, et cetera. So I think, we cannot underestimate the power of algorithms and disinformation in this time period. Secondly, I do think that disinformation only works if it contains some kind of perceptual truth. So when the Republican Party says to Black men in cities, and when you bring someone like Kamala Harris, who's a prosecutor, who rightfully her record is not great, someone like Joe Biden, who authored the crime bill, and you say, okay, you have nothing to lose with the Republican Party because look, your cities are run by Democrats and there's still police shootings and police killings. You can't argue against that. Is actually a fact. But the alternative, which is this really regressive and white chauvinist and a regressively neoliberal capitalism, not even neoliberal, but just theft that the Republican Party platform actually is, people, I don't think, realize that in fact the Republicans are worse. And I think it is manipulation, targeted manipulation, disinformation.
You brought up Kamala Harris. She's the daughter of immigrants. Is that important to you?
As the child of immigrants as well.
Well, I wasn't even thinking about that. I guess I was just thinking, like, does it matter? Does the biography matter? And if the biography matters, is that important to you? Is your social class important to you? I mean, what matters to you?
Oh, my God. To me, it just kind of kills me because immigrant in the U.S. is a shorthand for two classes of kind of immigrants, you know, like early 20th century Southern European Jewish working class poor assimilates and rises up in American society, or just recent migration, like Latino migration, which is also erroneously thought of as, you know, these poor people looking for refuge, et cetera, and this American dream. But I think what people don't realize since the 1960s up until today is that we recruited, immigration policies stopped being explicitly racist in 1965 with the Immigration Naturalization Act. So that significantly increased immigration from Asia, professional immigration, and some refugees, but professional immigration from India, the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. So this is why American cities have largely diversified in such a way that they have, and why a lot of these immigrants occupy professional classes. And that's what they were recruited to do. So, I mean, even in this case of my own family, my aunt studied at Makerere College in Uganda. She's a pediatric nephrologist. She came in the 1980s. I mean, she's not technically a refugee, but she left because of conflict. But Makerere College was the Harvard of Africa, trained by the governments of post-colonial states. You know, then the 1980s hit, you have structural adjustment and privatization first in the third world, in Latin America and Africa, has dire consequences for those societies. And, you know, you push people who are trained by these, you know, decolonizing states, and they come to the US and to Europe as professionals, and those societies have lost these people. So even Kamala Harris is a child of this kind of migration stream. You know, both of her parents met in doctoral programs at UC Berkeley. This isn't someone who has struggled with poverty. This isn't someone who has struggled with racialized poverty. This is someone who got lucky in many of the ways through the contingency of, I mean, she probably had to deal with prejudice and social prejudice, of course, and confusion. But this is not someone that you can ever say structurally has kind of lived through the immigrant experience that we have all these schemas around in US society. It's not the case. So I think part of this way of talking about immigration and is to kind of reinforce the notion of American exceptionalism, to get rid of the question of class, and then also to not have to deal with the uncomfortable legacy of US-based slavery, of chattel slavery. I mean, in many ways, her Jamaican heritage is being also erased a lot in media coverage. And I have to remind people that Jamaica was also a slave colony.
Yeah, Fiore, why do you think it's being erased?
I mean, I think she's Obama redux in some ways, in terms of the cultural politics. I mean, I read this great short piece in The Guardian by Samuel Moyne, who's a historian at Harvard. He wrote the book, The Last Utopia, about the fall of socialism and decolonization. And he said, you know, called her and Obama the child, the moderate child of radical parents. So these are people who, you know, they came to US institutions because they wanted to transform their societies at home. You know, that's why someone like Obama's father did his PhD, I think, at Harvard, right, in economics, and why Kamala Harris's father is an emeritus professor at Stanford in economics. So these are people who had a vision of radical transformation of their societies. And then their kids came out and said, no, we don't believe in that. You know, pragmatism, radical dreams don't work, screw radicalism. But the ways that they kind of got uptaken, you know, in terms of how the identity and cultural politics was that, you know, they didn't carry the resentment or the baggage that African Americans carry. That's the tacit kind of subliminal, the the message that's being sent out. I mean, she's non-US Black and from two parents with elite educated backgrounds. Let's not forget Obama's mother also had a PhD in anthropology. And so, you know, all of these facts about class, migration, et cetera, get effaced in the, these people are brought up as a paragon of the possibilities of multiracial and in some ways post-racist, not post-racial, but post-racist American society, which I think is overblown.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that off air. It's all something I've either thought about or said, but I just wanted to make a quick point that Kamala's father, Donald Harris, actually wrote the introduction to a monthly review classic of Nikolai Bukharin's The Economic Theory of the Leisure Class. So to Fiore's point, this is not a man who is just some, you know, centrist coming here and saying, I'm going to make a good living and kick back. He was really thinking of big things and big issues. But also to that point, you know, there's a story. I think it's the Miliband's, whose, of course, father was Ralph, the great Marxist political scientist, who was, I believe, at the LSE, who fled. I think it was Poland during World War II because he was Jewish. Of course, he had two sons who rose in the Labor Party. And the story goes that at some point, and this reminds me of both Obama and Harris, that they looked at their father and they're like, oh, that's all you became? And we can become so much more. And I think something similar happened with these two, that they looked at their parents and just said, oh, I can rise. And whatever that means, whatever I got to do it, I'm going to do it. And they left their parents' radical backgrounds behind.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I think Pete Buttigieg's dad is a Gramsci scholar at Notre Dame.
He is.
And from Malta, and Buttigieg is actually an Arabic name.
Oh, my goodness. And I'm reading this Prisoners of the American Dream by Mike Davis. It's an old book. It's, I think, 85 or 86. It was first published, but 86. But in his epilogue, he sort of predicts a lot of what would actually transpire. And he says that the major failure with the left, it has its roots in the failure of American labor to link up with Blacks and Latinos here in the United States and also people in the global South and to oppose U.S. imperialism. And one of the things that strikes me is that, and this is my experience, I'm wondering what you think about this, if you've had the same experience, if maybe you could explain what you think is going on. It strikes me that it's very difficult to bring imperialism into the conversation about what ails the United States. Even when we're talking about racism here in the United States, it's quite difficult to make those, to make the connection between white supremacy here and imperialism abroad. And I'm wondering if you find it also difficult to talk to people about imperialism, and if so, why you think that might be the case.
Yeah, I wonder what happened if the connection was lost after the Vietnam War between imperialism and racism and the draft and the fact that even during the Iraq wars, you know, you didn't see Black kids forced to go fight some foreign third world country when Black people are getting killed in this country by cops. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it. And just the defeat of the left, you know, like after that period, and of course the defeat of leftist discourse. So I think that would be kind of an incoherent answer to your question. I'm sure Fiore could go on about that as well.
I mean, I think a real problem though too is also the targeted prosecutions, politically based prosecutions and extrajudicial killings of members of the Black Panther Party, anti-war groups. In the 50s, you had the McCarthy trials. So you had, I mean, the state did have a hand in pretty much destroying any kinds of incipient anti-colonial, anti-imperialist movements. So there's that. I think there's also nationalism is really powerful. It's quite a drug, as I like to say. And the narrative of American exceptionalism makes it really hard for people to link up forms of displacement and dispossession and abandonment at home to anything that's happening abroad. But there's also other kinds of trends with journalism. You know, we've gotten rid of, most major bureaus have gotten rid of international coverage. So no one knows anything about anywhere else in the world. And I think to the point about the draft, you know, once the military became voluntary and they got rid of mandatory drafts, you know, it became the only vehicle for social mobility for a lot of people, and the only space in which you actually had the provisioning of social welfare. So people believe in the illusion that they're choosing to serve when the circumstances around them actually condition the possibility, the choices that they have. And I think that that's really lost. One thing that happened with the war in Iraq was that, you know, undocumented immigrants could serve in the war in Iraq, but be entered into a lottery for the green card. So, you know, instead of the state mandating, the state kind of conditions possibilities so that people believe that what is a choice exercise of free will is actually really not, is not really a choice, in fact.
This was a strange election. The Democrats did not do as well as at least the pundit class thought they would do, and I guess that they thought they would do. And in fact, while it looks like Biden will be the next president, and the Democrats looks like they'll lose a bunch of seats in the House, and they may not get the Senate. Certainly they're not going to get, you know, 52 or 54 seats. At the same time, the DSA did really well around the country. What do you make of that? How do you understand the fact that the right continues to do well, but that there is an ascendant DSA? And I also wonder whether you think that that electoral strategy for the left is working and will work in the long term.
Well, the first answer for me is a little easier. I think the conditions of 08, the great financial crash, the conditions that led to the rise of the right also led to the rise of the new left. The conditions that led to Occupy Wall Street also led to the Tea Party. That led to Bernie, also led to Trump. So I think that we shouldn't be surprised that there's an ascendant left. As to the strategies moving forward, that I'm completely flummoxed by.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm like, classically, what is to be done, right? Classically speaking. I would like to see I think Vijay Prashad says it, just more organizing on the leftist basis outside of just elections, organizing communities. And what does that mean? Being able to show human beings that there's a different way, that there's an alternative way to live, that there are different structures, economic, social, political, and that we're going to probably have to have some organization to do that. I'm not sure if the DSA is the organization to do that. They may be, and they may be what we need right now. They may be the limit to what we can do right now for a whole host of reasons, historical, social. So, but what needs to be done, I think, will inevitably be more than what the DSA is doing. Although, of course, I'm happy that some people who declare themselves socialists have won some spots. But in the end, I think we're going to have something much more robust. That's very, very kind of vague and glib. But
well, no. So, I mean, Vijay Prashad, he also says, you know, the unions were the site. Mm-hmm. The unions were the site for political education. Mm-hmm. The unions are gone. And so now, you know, the worker comes to, you know, the job site and sees that wages are flat or they've lost their job. And someone's like, well, you know, it's the Chinese or it's the Mexicans. And there's no one to kind of explain the political economy, which is not actually hard, but it's just less obvious than saying, you know, it's the foreigner's fault. Or
yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, we often lament that people can't make sense of reality or can't ascertain what's going on in the world. Well, we can't be too mad at them. Liberals get really angry. You know, they're like, oh my God, they don't understand this. They're dumb.
But of course, they don't either.
I thought you were talking about liberals don't understand it. We get frustrated at them.
No, we get frustrated with them, but liberals get frustrated with, like, you know, with like the lower, with the quote unquote lower orders, you know, like, exactly. How could they vote for Trump? How could they do this? How could they do that? Well, there's no political organization. There's no structures explaining, like Vijay was saying, to people what's going on. You don't go in, you know, like it's all the fault of China. Well, why did industry move to China? Why, you know, what happened? How did that happen? explain that to us.
And Ernest, if I could say, you know, what's so interesting is it's so let's say the working class guy that comes to the factory and gets told that it's, you know, it's the Chinese who are at fault, you know, and they believe that's wrong. But it feels like when liberals say, well, you know, Trump won because of, you know, white men, that is equally, it's not wrong, but it's equally simplistic. And what it feels to me is that what's missing in both cases is that political economy.
Yeah. But it's interesting, I think, to bring up the question of China, though. But China is not really a fully kind of rapacious capitalist system at all. And there are Chinese factories in the US. There's also the fact that the Chinese own parts of the National Railroad in the UK, which is just really fascinating and bizarre. I mean, I think that sometimes we have to realize that, you know, the forms of capitalism that we're living through are really dynamic in many ways. And to kind of hedge away from a model of economic nationalism. But at the same time, there is unpaid forced labor in China, as there is when we think about the conditions of undocumented immigrants in the US. So I just think it's a bizarre, I mean, to talk to, I don't think even very many educated people understand what's going on right now. I don't think Paul Krugman has a very good understanding of what's going on right now. When you think about the kind of local structures and why the DSA was able to garner such support in urban areas mostly, it's because there have been networks of grassroots activists active there for a very long time. And you still have labor movements in cities because there is still labor. Whereas when you look at the deindustrialized heartland, it's going to be really hard, because part of the reason why labor had power is that labor was really important to the work of capital. Whereas right now, I mean, through deregulation, automation, and finance capitalism, we're going to have to think about, I think, new ways to resist financialization and the spectral capitalism around the world, criminal capitalism that's around the world.
Hello, everybody. It's Lev, and I want to extend an invitation to our second book club meeting, which will be happening on December 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It will once again be hosted by Fiore Sara Brahane, who is a PhD candidate at Brown University in the Department of Anthropology. And this time we're going to be reading a book called Radical Happiness by Lynn Siegel. So if you're interested in attending, please fill out the form on our website at acorrectionpodcast.com. We welcome everybody. We are going to try to cap the number of people at about 15. Our first book club meeting filled up pretty quickly. So if you're interested, please go to our website today, www.acorrectionpodcast.com, and sign up. It's $10, and we'll use that money to pay our host.